Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about... Back on the road again, hopefully with a sensible microphone arrangement. So the last couple of podcasts I've had to can because the sound quality's been so low. And it's one of these journeys, oh, far out. So I'm driving home and there's a sort of speeding ute coming past. I'll talk a bit about driving this particular time. But we'll first talk about the microphone saga. Now, one of the things I have found is that walking, in your podcast and walk, you really need a directional microphone. So you can speak into it and you get all the traffic sound and all the variability of your places removed. Come on around here, it's time for me to whip around here. Looks as though I'm going to have quite a good run home. A directional microphone. Then I've got this little lapel omnidirectional microphone, right? And if I'm in the car, the only person speaking is reasonably good. Now, I am aware that the car has specific microphones built in, and if I can hijack those. But I experimented for a while trying to get a directional microphone just popped in the cup holder and positioned to here, and needless to say, this is absolutely dreadful. So the fundamental problem was that clinging it to my seatbelt, as my seatbelt moved, you heard this rustling sound, awful, coming across. So what I've done is I've actually plugged my lapel microphone into basically my lapel, which is sort of like... I suppose this is not genius. So eventually I'm going to have to research a microphone which goes out there so my lapel doesn't rustle as I move back and forth in the car seat go along there. And I suppose the only other thing is I used to drive really close to the front seat because from my heart conditions, you had to push your shoulder back after the heart operation. Well, let's go through the heart operation. Heart operation, they slice you open, then they get this jigsaw, this little stainless steel jigsaw, and they jigsaw through your sternum at a certain rate, to pressure at a certain diamond saw. So it's a very nice, neat break, and it breaks your bone either side. You would think that you would paint it with something. I wonder if they do paint it, open it. So that's pulled across, and then they get some springs and pull your chest apart. So then they wire your sternum is then wired up together. You can't put it in a brace, so they get some wire, fencing wire, and twist it up. And that stays in with you forever, so you get that there. And I suppose what they also do is they leave electrodes. Once you've got your heart there, so you start your heart, they have these little wires, little pads, so I suppose soluble pads. And so when you wake up, you have two wires, and what else do you have? You have three drainage tubes. I don't know why three, but I'll tell you what. They're a relief when you're full of fluid, but once you're out of fluid and you've got nothing more to drain, nothing more to give, the pain kicks in, and it's the twice going through the operation you feel that, and then you go, oh, and they said, oh, no, I'm beginning to feel pain around, and where are you? Just wait. No, you schedule half an hour for the people. Oh, it is a bit of relief when they pull it out. So there's all that there. Now, with all that trauma, you tend to be hunched over, and to avoid that, you drive really close to your steering wheel to push your shoulders back. My friend pointed out that I'm so close to this steering wheel, if the airbag ever goes, I'm cactus, you know. Well, I suppose the airbag should be fairly reliable in my book, but you know, that was enough. That was an argument for me, given that all the arguments are facetious. I like that. not specious, but facetious. Facetious. That's a facetious argument. Argument. Oh, I love that term going through. Facetious argument gone through. So that's a combination, trying to actually get the microphone in the correct position. Then I'll just hopefully say some driving stories as I go along. Oh. So I'm going in for the moment break, and I'll be with you in a tick. I'm back again with just checking my lapel microphone on again. I was going to talk to you about a few driving stories. When I thought about far out, I don't have any really interesting driving stories, but what came to my head is a few old army stories. I think they're sufficiently old that there's no risk associated with it, or you know, there's nothing classified associated with it. I just want to talk about the time with the Leopard tanks in Pakapanyong. So let's talk about what a Leopard tank is. Now, of course, the Germans somehow had the mystique of the tank, particularly because our tanks were so crap in World War II, and the German tanks, when they were built by all these different manufacturers and interchangeable parts, they were meticulously designed the Porsche of tanks. And you know, the various tanks were legendary. The Panzer, the Panther D, the Tiger tank, and there's the story of how Britain got hold of its one Tiger tank in the desert. In that the British fired a shell into the tank. It the turret got stuck. They abandoned the tank without torturing it, and then, of course, the British were able to take a tank and have a look at it. These were beautiful machines, and of course, many, many years later, after the Australians have, you know, really had quite crap. Oh no, we had some quite good tanks, Centurion tanks and stuff like that. I think the Israeli army still has Centurion tanks. The mind boggles why anyone would have a tank nowadays. However, we had the Leopard tank. To my surprise, the Leopard tank were shipped out in in kits and made up at Lithgow. Well, this is over the mountains. Well, at least some of them were. We just didn't have a ship arrive with the tanks. We sort of pretended we manufactured them. And, of course, we put the Aussie upgrades, the Aussie engines in them to survive. I think the Germans had a little bit of idea about tanks in the desert, but however, that being said, it's pretty amazing that the productive power of Germany is absolutely mind-boggling. So Australia for a while had, a fair number of years, had the Leopard tank, and they were impressive beasts. I do remember, if you can imagine, in a suburb called Watsonia. This is a small thing. There was a suburb called Watsonia, and there was a tank and infantry display, and we had to be the infantry, because it wouldn't get real infantry. We were just, you wouldn't call militia citizens infantry, or I don't know what you call them. We're under military law and all that type of crap, but I don't think you could lock one of us up in the brig and throw away the key or anything like that. In fact, do they have a military prison here in Australia? I don't know how it operates. There's the military police and all that type of stuff. I think during peacetime, it's a bit unlike the United States, where they're almost in a permanent state of war, and they have a sort of a big. We do have the. Once you enter a military base, it's under military, I think military law, but yeah, and it's Oh, well, I can say at least from studying... to be a NCO, you have to study military law. There you go. A corporal and a... Oh, in fact, everyone is trained in military law. And the fact is that there's no law which cancels out another law. There you go. So you're under civil law. Everyone's under civil law all the time, 24 hours a day. Then you're under military. You're under the law of the land or the place that you're at, 100%. You're under that, unless. Look, it's very, very rare. I don't know how it operates. Then you're under Australian military law. There's a legal system there. And there's this whole system of codified law. So Australia's under common law, and the military law is not common law. It's a codified law. And then they've got sections that you got under. But you can really... something called, there's in military law, something called prejudicial conduct. That is something like you can be charged for being unsoldierly. There you go.
Look.
Imagine that if you could be charged for being uncitizenly, but say if you do something like urinate in public or swear in uniform or anything like that, if anything which brings the Australian Army into disrepute, sort of loudy behaviour. Say if I was in Australian uniform and I said something racist, there's no complex sort of rights and stuff like that. They just say, oh, panel people say, oh, that's unsoldierly, you know, tradition, blah blah blah. So it's a fairly, this in terms of right down at the infantry level, you know, the sergeant down, the law's pretty straight, and of course you can be all sorts of laws you can be done. Obviously, there's the big one for infantry is unauthorized discharge. So if you are locked and loaded and you're ready for an attack and you're sneaking up and it goes poom because you trip on a log and think it's not, there's there's no error. It's slightly different. Like the people aren't. But it's also not a legal system which, for certain things, the officer in charge can charge you and punish you. It's a little system. So you could have. a platoon of infantry up in Northern Territory, and so-and-so doesn't look after their weapon you can be on a military charge for not wearing a hat. Now this is serious, because in the Australian you can get charged for sunburn. Now, sunburn is that, say if you got sunburn and you didn't have your boots on, that would be quite a serious charge in the Australian Army, because not having your boots on is that you're putting your foot at risk and you're compromising the efficiency of the unit. And also, sunburn is a self-inflicted injury, so you have to get. You have to wear sunscreen. That's the end of it. End of story. You also have to wear a hat. Or say, for instance, you're in an orders to for for total silence and you speak, you can be charged. Like, so if the order comes out, it's silent operations, no one speaks, there's no noise. It's absolutely, you know, I forgot what is it, it's the, in terms of complete silence, and like, the order can be a hand signal. So if you want complete silent operations, the hand signal is a hand over your mouth, pass down, or like, say if you get a signal and you don't pass the signal on to the other troops, that's a chargeable offence. There you go. So, but the entire thing is not operated like that. It's very much so the Australian Army's always been the very small army, very elite army, but still, you know, I would say there's crazy officers and stuff like that. I was going to talk about the Leopard tanks, and one of the things, I don't know whether modern tanks, the old Leopard tanks had a little telephone at the back you could pick up and you could speak, you could, so the I don't know why you had a telephone at the back. You can go behind the Leopard tank and say, look, I'm the lieutenant such and such, please lay so much around. The infantry would be there doing target indications, and they'd ask, oh, please put a 50 caliber, you wouldn't say please, you'd give a target indication, and through the telephone at the back, they would be as effectively as another infantry. Not that this would ever happen. Like, what are you doing with a tank being perfectly stationary? But apparently that's what happened. So there's like a telephone, but not a booth at the end, a little cover you lift up, and a little telephone with a little coil thing. This is before mobile phones. A landline, and you can actually telephone up the tank, and you'd say, I joked around because I was always very formal. Good evening. This is the infantry speaking, not quite like that. They had one is the tanks have a limited road capacity before you have to redo the treads. What is it? The treads have these rubber things you put in it, and so it's very much an infantry unit will get so many kilometres worth of tank. I think it's not exactly like that. They can actually, in their planning, they plan for how far the tanks can go, and then it's a big, whoa, are you okay? That one. Sorry, these lights changed and I had this person next to me going too fast, pull out and go through the red. There you go, not me. So let's see, I think military convoys have a speed limit on them, and you can be in a speed zone with all the speed signs, and the military police can still charge you for speeding. Not that I've ever seen that done. Was I terrified of military police? Not really, but it's sort of crazy, crazy, crazy times. Now, again, for the military law, stuff like that, I don't know whether it's changed, but you had to, there was a complexity because you could, back in the day, you would, it's just the simplest thing is, you know, you've got one evening a week, one weekend a month, 2 or 3 weeks a year. So that's a, you know, let's talk about it. That's a fair whack of time. You know, you're actually 1 or 2 weekends a month, depending on what you're doing. Like there's the standard training weekend plus a specialist training plus a month. You could clock up easily without trying 25%. It's sort of like a fifth of the year in military training easily. If you wanted to just keep your capacity up, the minimum amount of time is probably 5 weeks all up cumulative, which is a fair whack of time. Yeah, it's 10% of a year, but there's more to it than that in terms of if you are to go through courses or do support. You know, there's maybe a support exercise you have to go on or something like that. You can easily or could have easily popped up. What I was wanting to talk about is that back in the day, you had to actually you would get dressed at your home, and then as a dressed up soldier you would just go into work. Not much fun. The times have changed now. There's this very much like, here you go, guns are banned in Australia. If someone has a gun, most people report them to the police immediately. If you've got a rifle and you are in a suburban city, a rifle or a handgun in a suburban city, and people see it, inevitably you will be reported to the police. So it's not that you are threatening or something like that. Obviously, concealed weapons are completely illegal. So a concealed weapon is illegal. So if you had a coat on and someone saw a holster under the coat, that's a charge in Australia. You're not allowed to do that. You're not allowed to have a concealed weapon. You're not allowed to have a knife. You can't sell knives. Say in a supermarket, if you buy a kitchen knife, you know, like a fruit knife. So this is a knife capable of cutting open an orange. You know, you can't cut orange with a butter knife. You need something with a bit of a point to it. And you go up, you can pick it up in the aisle, put it there, and you go to put it through. Not an alarm will sound, but this is, you know, online. This cash register, you put it through, you scan it, and immediately a tent, oh, far out, shit, don't scare the fruitcake out of me. Someone's turning into the traffic there. It would have been an accident if they weren't looking what was going on. Okay, so the attendant will come up and say, blah, 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 like that. Sort of a similar type of sort of very aggressive. Now, is Australia a safer place due to, it's definitely not the same level of gun violence, but I wouldn't be so cocksure there's possibly not the same level of drunken violence, well, particularly in Sydney. They've just now closed all the hotels for staying open late. Sort of a bit of a draconian place. I can sort of imagine you would definitely be surprised if there was. It's probably going to be, obviously, the Australian and the mass shooting. We just can't stop it. But that being said, part of the general gist is not wearing uniforms of military people in public. You are encouraged most of the time. And we've got an Air Force base up the top of our little Glenbrook. And if they're on a lunch break, the Air Force people come in uniform, but they're not highly coloured uniform. They're a bit of camouflage, stuff like that, to the local cafe, and that's it. But you won't see them after hours. If you are working as a soldier in an area, you're not expected to go in civvies. But say if you were a civilian performing a soldierly thing for military law reasons, you go in civilian uniforms, and the moment you walk into the base as a soldier to be paid, even though you're in civilian uniform, you are a soldier, and then you dress up. But once you're dressed up, you're a soldier all the time that you're dressed up. And I think that's true for police as well, that you're on duty from the moment, like, you get paid from the moment you get into the car, your police car or something like that, but the moment you are in your bedroom and you pin on the badge, you ostensibly can do it. And there's other things. I wish I could just describe it, but I wanted to talk about tanks. I'm sure a lot of people are interested in it. So we had the Watsonia display, and this tank reversed over a private Uglo, I remember. Reversed over the top. Now, fortunately, he was in a ditch, so the tank went over the top, so he was okay. There was a bit of an incident report on that one. That would have been rather say, oh, well, I went and saw a this is Watsonia base, and we won't do it like that. Then I did possibly 2 months with tanks at Puckapunyal. So Puckapunyal was in Victoria. It's still in Victoria. Paka. Marching out parade at Puckapunyal. A few units used to practice up there and go off to war and all that little crap. And we had marching parades and all that palaver. It was the home of the tank. Now, of course, now the idea of, putting tanks in central, we'll put the tanks are up in all northern Australia. Now, of course, way up northern Australia, it's the big top band of tropical Australia is, if you read the maps, danger crocodiles, and it's pretty tough. It's not really tank country anyway. Puckapunyal was beautiful tank country, but it's sort of, they're all been deployed up north. I think there are a tank unit, I think there was a tank unit up around Canberra. So a tank unit is, there's 9 or 10 tanks in a tank platoon or squadron. A squadron has 3 troops in it, and so we would get a troop of tanks for a regiment of infantry. 3 is quite enough, mind you, for how many would be 600 in the regiment, and you get quite a lot of tank time because they'd be with you all the time. And I do remember digging into this hill, and first you'd feel, some people say, look, I can feel something. Of course, the people in the back then, I was just a corporal, and people say, feel that rock, that rock's vibrating, very low vibration. And then you hear this deep, throaty diesel sound, and of course this is the entire idea of a tank sneaking up on you. Okay, and then like this, and then you'd be there, and you'd see the hill, over the ridge of the hill, these light flashes, and we're standing here going, what the fuck is that? So you'd see a flash, and then it would go away, and then a flash from another point of the hill. And so this entire hill range here used to go up with little flashes. And of course, what the what was happening was the troop was doing. I really don't know whether this is effective anymore. I think this is sort of fantasy warfare. They would pre-program themselves. I don't know how they do it, but to just burst over the top, fire, and pull back. So they would go up over the top, fire, pull back. Then while the other one was firing, it would move around. Look, this is... They're not... it would fire and then it would just move 3 meters. This is 100 meters. I don't know. It would be pretty insane to be in these tanks. So they would go... Sort of manoeuvre up and fire. And this is true. The little flashes go... I suppose it must have been my own imagination that they were the flashes were from more than three positions. It seemed to be more than three positions. And perhaps, being Pakapunnel, they knew this area really well, programmed up. And then the tanks swept after completely blasting our position, apparently, with flashlights, with an out rounds, it came up, and we were told this gun pit. We were told you have to be out of it. Make sure everything's out of it. Absolutely, it's everything out of it. And then the tank, one of the tanks, came up and just went round and round and just ground it down. And still, of course, people afterwards said, "Oh, look, it's actually if you stayed in there, you would have survived because it was." But they wouldn't. Yeah, like it was. 5 foot deep, and then after the tanks had gone, it was 3.5 feet deep. So if you really crouched down, you could, it wouldn't have been a very nice thing to have gone on. That was the tanks, and as infantry, we used to have to go out and try and find them, find a tank. Wasn't it hard? Because the tanks at night go in hides. Like tiger, or like animals, that go out and they form a defensive perimeter with hide in the bush. And look, a lot of the time there are no trees. I don't know how this operates. This is in some sort of fantasy land. How you could hide a tank in a something like that. And apparently, so tanks and infantry. So infantry are really dispersed, but if you've got an anti-tank weapon, the entire thing is you've got to wait till the tank is right up close and it's a dead on hit. So it's rather hard with all their infrared detectors and stuff like that. And so back, we're talking 80s. Back then the tanks had carbon dioxide laser rangefinders, all types of stuff, and they also had fairly sophisticated radio eavesdropping equipment in terms of I don't know whether this is that they were working on it or it's actually stuff, but they could actually, if you put on your radio, they could work out where you were. So, they had all that type of stuff, but they also we had to get up early one morning for, I think we were at Melbourne University and we were attacking Monash University. Now this is all gone by the gone. I think the army has such a low presence in universities now that I'm still pretty sure the university regiments still go, but it's a completely different attitude. I think the identity of a university which with a regiment and history has been sort of dissolved because they swap in and out officers so quickly. I don't think people have the long-time residents. So we used to have people had been in the unit 20, I was in 15 years, okay, well, but I was in different, was it Melbourne University, Adelaide University, ANU, Australian National University, and then Macquarie University, and back to Sydney University. As I moved over, I just would, as my university career went along, I just used to pop on onto the different regiments. That was always fun. I just met there was something really special about the army in South Australia. I sort of really liked South Australia quite a lot. The Pako was was a whole lot of armour, and got a lot of Air Force things with these completely. I thought they were marvellous, but hearing later that they're absolute crap. Planes, Caribous, and you know, oh, it was pretty amazing type of stuff. Be able to, you know, basically they could land in a football field, which is really short, and basically they had these huge engines. Now, apparently, we Australians got an early order. So these are Vietnam War era aircraft. You're going, oh, hacking. So these were in the 60s aircraft, and we were still in the 80s to 90s flying in them. And apparently, we thought nothing of it. You had to put ear protection in to be near them, and they had this huge, absolutely huge roaring noise. And of course, the latest American replacements, the Spartans, were much, much better. But I do remember this Lieutenant Harris, and what had happened is that the tanks and the infantry didn't meet the correct coordinates, and the tanks had to come and pick us up, and it was getting light, and the tank commander got really angry, you know, how the fuck, you know, like this. And so he said, infantry, you know, you're on the top of the tank. And we went in, and the infantry commander said, look, we're still not going to attack it because it's now too light, we'll get wiped out and stuff. And there's all that concertina wire, all that thing. There's just too much, we're not going to risk it. And the tank commander just got the thing, and he so as we were going up to the area, I remember as corporal on top, and I was told, tell them if they're going to fall off, push yourself clear of the tracks. And I've never forgotten that basic, you know, not worrying about all the things that are wrong and stuff like that, but at this point, the wrong thing, if you don't do this next thing, you're really stuffed. And I can't quite describe it, but it's for me, that's one of the sayings I've always got myself in my head, in terms of that you're in a pretty dicey situation, and there's a lot of risks, but you still have to do a risk assessment of the riskies. It's sort of like, you're in a risky, the first object is, in a risky situation, don't do it, okay? The second one is that if you're in a risky situation and you're in it, observe the risk and actually minimise that particular risk. So push yourself clear of the tracks. That's always reminded me of Lieutenant Harris, who had done physics at Berkeley. It was his thing. I sort of remember him up there, and he said, anyone here done some physics? And I thought, I'll put my hand up. And so I had a good old physics chat with him, because the thing is, the tanks were
you know, all buckets, but you know, I don't know what sort of scientists, but, you know. Oh, look, there was a few various engineers. No, what I would call, you wouldn't get very many math. Yeah, no quality mathematicians. Chemists. Yeah, I was trying to think that. Now, of course, I suppose one of the things that I just really liked at high speed, the leopard tank, or at least the Australian leopard tanks at that stage, had slightly more advanced motors, or they just went faster, and of course that used to cause all this sort of other problems. But what's happened is I think they've all been retired. Now what we generally tend to do, I don't know how this operates, you know, what the heck is going on. So when we have a tank, something at the end of lifetime, and all this type of stuff, or I think sometimes a ship or aircraft, they're actually quite expensive at the end of lifetime to decommission. Oh, sorry. Particularly aircraft require heaps of so all our old Hercules, I don't think we would have given the tanks away. I think they would have gone to scrap, and and particularly if you're a Pacific Island nation, far out. Having a tank is actually not that useful, because you've only got, you know, a square kilometre of land. I mean, a tank would be very significant there, but it wouldn't be able to go and hide anywhere. It couldn't bugger off 30 kilometres away and, you know, lick its wounds or anything like that. And New Zealand is, I think, just... Australia's an ideal tank country, obviously, because it's all flat and all subtle. It's no point being a tank unless you've got total air superiority. Otherwise, don't call it a tank, call it a tanga. So you need, you know, a whole combination of factors. And I think Australian air... it's just outrageous. The... I think Australia, New Zealand. I think this may be right. At a certain time, New Zealand got rid of its air force. It said, "We're not having any more." And it used to have MiGs, and so these MiGs, although they were cared for by the New Zealand Air Force, and they're fairly robust planes, they used to be able to. You can go and fly a MiG jet in Australia. It's a MiG jet experience, and something I just really wouldn't capture my wants and desires to go across. And of course, Australia's now has got the big Abrams tank, and I yeah, logistically, I just don't know how, you know, they chew through fuel and stuff like that, and they're sort of super heavy, and apparently they're fantastic tanks, but, you know, you just got to scratch your head, you know, like that. They're a super heavy, tank, this is the Abrams tanks. I don't know how they perform and stuff. I'm totally out of it. Be interesting to speak to people, but of course you don't get any sort of, you know, detail. You get really detailed information about, like, apparently the people really love the Centurion tanks. There's the Leopard tanks could be souped up to be quite a force, and the big. Big question is under what circumstances would you use armor? Now, I think we still have the Lancers, and the Lancers are there's an APC, there's two APC units. personal carriers are called Christmas boxes, because they open up with a little present of infantry rushing out the back, and that's sort of a strange thing. I think they're more good as a rescue if the shit hits the fan, but they've basically got no armour. They've got basically there's as much protection as the paint on the outside. So rather than if an APC had armour, we've learnt a lot from the South Africans and South Africans. Now we've got the Bushmaster armoured cars, and I think these are armoured personnel carriers with the big, big six-wheeled stuff and the anti-mines. It's got the APC is really sort of Vietnam era type of, it's the classic straight sort of armoured, basically a travelling toilet to come across going forward. Now it's pretty amazing to see what's going on. I suppose the other thing is that you sort of get an era of sort of people in a firefight, all the ping ping ping. There's nothing like a 50 caliber machine gun. It's just that is by far, that sort of puts the end, like a 50 cal machine gun puts the end. So 50 caliber is 5 centimeters across. Now that's I suppose it is a bullet, but it's more a cannon. I'd call it basically a cannon shell. And so a 50 cal will go through most things, will blow sandbags apart. There's not much that can survive 50 cal, and when the 50 cal say hits the ground in front of infantry, it digs up. It's just basically a hand grenade. So I just can't describe how devastating it is. So a lot of people and a lot of the action movies, everyone's going with their little uses, like this is sort of like play acting. But when you've got these big things, these big, I don't think people really understood just how dangerous it is and how unfair it is. It really is. Really is unfair to see how things go. Okay, I'm back home, and it's interesting talking about those things. And I'll listen to the recording and see how good this is. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.